A very smart update, and I appreciate her giving that input, so I think I'm fine with it. So thanks for checking in.
I'm happy to say I have enough coffee in my system.
The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Thank you all for coming this morning. We appreciate your attendance. We have a very full calendar today. Thank you very much. We have a very full calendar today. I would like to get underway immediately, and we're going to start by opening a public hearing on House Bill 4142. Who's on that one? Ah, yes, Christine, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4142 would change the definition of a rural area for the purpose of the Strategic Investment Program. When there is a urban strategic investment, there's an investment requirement of $100 million in order to participate in that program. When there is a rural strategic investment program participant, they are only required to spend $25 million. The firm will pay tax on that first amount, either 25 or 100 million, and then would be exempt for the rest of their amount. So they would also pay community service fees in addition to those amounts. So it would be advantageous to a particular firm to be defined as a rural SIP because they receive more exemption and also have a lower threshold for investment. And there's a dash one amendment in OLIS. It would change the requirement that the project eligible for the rural strategic investment program be outside the urban growth boundary of a city of 40,000 or more in population instead of a city of 30,000 or more in population. About covers it. That change from 30,000 to 40,000 wouldn't have additional revenue impacts, at least as far as the programs that are in rural SIPs are concerned.
Great. Good morning.
Good morning.
Who would like to go first?
I will go first.
Great. Please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson, and I represent House District 47, which includes parts of Portland east of I-205. I'm here today to bring you House Bill 4142 concerning the Strategic Investment Program, or SIP. So I just want to provide some background on the SIP. I know most of you on the Revenue Committee are very familiar with this, but just for the record, the Strategic Investment Program provides traded sector companies a 15-year property tax abatement based on the size of their investment. There can be two kinds of SIP: an urban SIP, which places a cap of $100 million on the value that can be taxed, and a rural SIP, which places a lower cap of $25 million. Companies eligible for the SIP must also pay a community service fee, which is on 25% of their untaxed value. And these are also capped $2 million for urban SIPs and $500,000 for rural SIPs. There's also a piece of this that has to do with gain share, which returns 50% of employees' income tax back to the communities where these companies are located. So I wanted to start out by saying what this bill does not do. For the record, this bill doesn't have anything to do with ending a SIP, altering the size of the investment that is needed to qualify for a SIP. It doesn't have anything to do with the community service fees, gain share, or anything having to do with how the taxes are spent within the SIPs. Instead, this bill deals with an inequity between who qualifies for an urban SIP and who qualifies for a rural SIP. So why is there a difference between the rural and urban SIPs? The crafters of this program initially wanted to encourage rural economic vitality and get jobs into rural counties. So for the purposes of the SIP, areas designated as rural qualify for rural SIPs, and areas designated as urban qualify for urban SIPs. As set in the statute dealing with SIPs, ORS 285C600, the term rural area means an area located entirely outside of the urban growth boundary with a city of a population of 30,000 or more, as the urban growth boundary was set on December 1st, 2002. Since that date, over 11 years ago, the urban growth boundaries have grown. Thousands of acres have been added to them. Now we have thousands of what would otherwise be designated as urban eligible acres, which are now included for rural SIPs. despite being inside the urban growth boundary. In the Portland area alone, 5,300 industrial acres inside the UGBs are eligible for rural SIPs. Since these urban areas can offer property tax benefits equal to those outside the UGBs, the rural areas of our states have lost their competitive advantage of the rural SIP. This bill does three main things. First of all, it changes the criteria used to determine whether land is considered for a rural SIP or whether it is urban SIP eligible from the urban growth boundary as it was set in 2002 to the date on which an applicant submits an application. So it keeps it, so for today or when this bill becomes law, it would be for whatever the current urban growth boundary is, and then it would go from there with any changes that were made going forward to the urban growth boundary. I do understand the importance of tax certainty for the businesses, and so it is in Section 2 of this bill, we are grandfathering in those existing projects which qualify for strategic investment program now, so we're not going to be doing any changes to those properties in the zone. There's also a -1 amendment for your consideration, which, as Christine stated, increases the size, increases the population of the cities that are eligible for the rural SIP to 40,000. This will bring in Grants Pass and McMinnville. You have a handout there that shows some of the populations of different cities. You'll probably see some in your district listed there. This change was inadvertently left off of the original bill. So this is a good bill. It's short and sweet. I'm doing it for two reasons. One thing is that I've learned that Oregon tax policy is very complicated. So if you were designing a stable, logical tax system from scratch, you wouldn't include things like the kicker, or you would include things like, some of the elements of our current property tax system. So each of us on this committee has a desire to make positive changes to our tax system, but it's very difficult, I've learned, it's very difficult to make broad sweeping changes. But this is a positive change that we can make to the tax tool that drives investment, but making it work fairly and more efficiently. And the second reason for doing this is that I believe that rural areas in Oregon need all the help that they can get. On the committee, we've had opportunity to hear how the Oregon economic picture is looking, and we hear time and time again that the metro area, while we're recovering from the recession, we're doing so at a much better rate than our rural areas. And so I think this is a way that as Oregon moves forward as a whole, we can bring rural areas along with us, and I think that's very important. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Hicks.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Representative Wally Hicks from Josephine County. About once a session, it seems, I appear before this committee to testify in favor of some bill or another, and I'm very proud that this is the bill that brings me before you this session. House Bill 4142, especially as amended in the -1 amendment, is going to, or has the potential to be, a very big deal where I live. And I want to thank Representative Vega Peterson for bringing the legislation before you and urge its passage. I have told this committee previously about the public safety problems that our community does have, and these problems flow ultimately to issues with our economy. And this is the kind of bill, the exact kind of bill, that could directly address the root of my community's current problems in regards to public safety and otherwise. And so for the sake of our rural economy, at least in my little part of the state, I do urge the committee to pass the bill and graciously appreciate your consideration of it.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you. Thank you very much for presenting this. Do we have data on, since the implementation of this rural SIP, how many we got in that are active in these rural and
Yeah,
you see what I'm getting at?
Yep, I do. And so I have additional data that I can get to, but my understanding is that there are about 18 current SIPs, and specifically in the Portland metro area. The majority of these, I think, were beneficiaries were Genentech and Intel. They have existing programs. I think with the numbers that Christine ran, these changes really only affect 10% of the revenue up and down of what would be
I guess what I'm interested in is this rural SIP program getting anybody in the rural area. That's my fundamental question. Are we getting rural SIPs?
No.
And would this number change get us more? And I have to put on the record that I have a little concern here when I look at this list that Kaiser goes in and Salem doesn't. Does that put, I mean, they are contiguous cities. Are we... And that's just one, and the same with Oregon City in the other Clackamas County areas. And I don't know whether those folks are going to speak to this or not, but I just wanted, I would need more information, and I really appreciate
it. Yep. And
don't want to put you on the spot right
no,
now.
No, no problem. And thank you, Chair Barnhart and Representative Berger. So for the increase from 30,000 to 40,000, the reason why the five cities that qualified, you know, with the increase in the population, three of those are already in urban SIPs because they're within their urban growth boundaries.
Okay.
Okay. So they're already considered.
They're already considered.
Yeah. Yep.
That wouldn't change their.
No. Okay. They wouldn't change their designation.
I think I needed that assurance. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Yes, Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this interesting bill. Could you refresh my memory, because we spoke yesterday about this, the original link of the SIPs to the 2002 urban growth boundary framework.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a reason for that, as opposed to just having included back then whatever the urban growth boundary might be as the deciding factor as to when one might get a rural or an urban SIP.
Yes, thank you, Chair Barnhart and Representative Benz. So we did talk about that yesterday. I haven't found specifically the in the record. I haven't gone back and looked at the transcripts of why that was put in. But my understanding is that there was one specific project that was in progress where there was land purchase that was being developed that they wanted to be sure would still qualify for the urban dollars, even though that after 2002 it would be part of the urban growth boundary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This slightly off from that, but the underlying, going back to Representative Berger's remark, the underlying thought is that if we make every new business that goes into a newly expanded area by virtue of the UGB expansion, that somehow making them fall within the higher level of tax, they will instead go to an urban or a rural area. That's the underlying thought.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it that it's not fair that some are getting a tax break when they're inside the rural area and others are not? Which is it that drives the bill?
Well, I think it can be, Chair Barnhart and Representative Benz, I think it can be both. But, I mean, it is to create a more equitable situation between incenting development in areas that are truly considered rural because they are outside you know, modern standards of the urban growth boundary. So that's definitely a piece of it. But then it's also, you know, and then it's not giving an unfair advantage to those folks who are in an urban area so that their tax rates going forward for new investment would match what was considered an appropriate tax rate for development in an urban area.
Mm-hmm. Final thought. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The thought or the opportunity for new businesses to enjoy the lower SIP rate in a newly expanded UGB, one might argue that that area that's brought into the newly expanded UGB was just very recently rural, and that this is still building on the original concept, which was to attract business to a rural area.
Yeah.
Is the underlying assumption that by virtue of the extension of the UGB, it suddenly has become non-rural, and therefore we're not going to allow this lower tax rate, if you will, even though there's just been a change in the label on the land?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz. So, I mean, I think I'm not a land use expert, but my understanding is the urban growth boundary is set to make sure that we have an adequate amount of land for expected development in the next 50 years. So this is land that's already expecting to become urban. You know, it has a closer access to some of the future development of infrastructure and things. So this is area that's going to be urban within an expected amount of time.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Chair. One more thing. And also, I mean, we're looking at 11 years since the boundary was first set. And I think that we can all say that in the last 10, 11 years, there's been a lot of growth already in some of these areas that are overlapping.
Do you have any information on the effect that this kind of change would have on the actual development in the urban areas that that would be affected by the bill? Is there any information about that you know about?
Chair Barnhart, I have the estimates that Christine put together in terms of what the difference might be, but again, and I have some information that I'll share with the committee after this, and I think it's a very small percentage that would actually be effective in terms of the overall program. But again, understanding that the existing companies that are using this were going to be grandfathered in, and so it's not going to affect that. That's not going to change it. I think it will be probably a very small delta, but I'll look for getting you more information on that.
I mean, the reason I ask the question is because I think every time we open a policy like this, we have to re-examine the but-for test. I mean, does the advantage provided by the rural SIP to areas that are actually urban actually make a difference in whether the development occurs or not? My suspicion is that it does, but only in a very small way, and I think that's what your answer indicates.
I think.
Okay. Any other questions? We have some other people to be heard. Thank you very much this morning for being here and ready to testify at 8 o'clock.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Members,
we have three witnesses to testify: Mark McMullen, Keith Peel, and Sarah Garnison. If those would come forward, are there other people who want to be heard on this bill this morning? Thank you. I think we'll hear from Mark first.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you, Chair Barnhart, member of the committee. Thank you for having me today. I'm just here to do some background on 4142.
That would be very helpful.
That would help.
In particular, talk just a little bit more about the issues with investment in our rural areas.
Oh, sorry. I've been reminded that you need to give us your name for the record.
Oh, for the record, I'm Mark McMullen. I'm a state economist with the Oregon Office of Economic Analysis. So, in terms of background, there's a real clear role in terms of state policymakers and encouraging investment in our rural areas. Our rural areas right now, some of them are in a very negative perpetuating cycle where they're losing a skilled workforce and their infrastructure is aging, which is making it difficult for them to attract employers to the area. And without the employers, of course, it becomes difficult to keep the skilled workers and to make investments pencil out. So in a lot of these areas, right now they're on a pretty negative trajectory, where we're seeing the infrastructure age and we're seeing a lack of new employers come to these areas. Now, recent times we have seen a lot of improvement in rural areas, and I don't want to gloss over that. The last few months we've seen Southern Oregon and Central Oregon come back along with the housing market, and most recently we've really seen some encouraging signs in the Salem metropolitan area in terms of private sector job growth. But overall, these challenges really haven't gone away. And insofar as we can change that trajectory by encouraging some investment in these areas to, again, attract jobs, attract workers, and keep us from out of this negative spiral, I think that's a positive thing. And we certainly hear this in our role in dealing with local interests, insofar as even having a negative outlook in terms of our forecast, which is used to determine UGBs or outlooks for business demand that are weak, it becomes hard to get some of these things to pencil in. If you're a business looking to invest in a hospital or in a port facility, one important thing is how much demand growth do you expect? In a lot of these areas that have stagnated for 30 years after losing major employers, it's hard to bank on a lot of that. But that's not to say if we didn't make some useful investments that we couldn't potentially put these areas on a different trajectory. So this is where we stand as a policy problem. Obviously, it's a difficult one if we're trying to stick our necks out on some riskier investments that might not necessarily pencil out right away. That is a risky proposition, but nevertheless, one that might be worthwhile as long as we our decisions don't fly in the face of existing land use laws. So that said, how are we doing? My written materials I sent you does have a summary of the Strategic Investment Program and where those participants have been located across the counties of the state. Roughly, some of the programs were crossed some county boundaries, so we couldn't isolate them. But as you'll see, rural counties haven't in participated quite a bit in the strategic investment program insofar as encouraging some investment, in particular the Eastern Oregon counties that have put in high-value wind energy projects. These projects have very large investment price tags attached to them and correspondingly have had large tax relief for these companies in these areas. Well over half of the strategic investment program dollars that have gone out, or rather have, or savings that have been issued. However, to date, not many of these projects, particularly the wind program, wind energy projects, have delivered a lot in terms of ancillary economic activity, jobs, and income to the areas. As you see, also, I've also put down the summary across counties of the gain share payments, which are associated with the jobs that are added. And of those, our one real success story in rural Oregon has been the paper mill in Clatsop County, where we have seen a significant boost in job creation. But to date, this, you know, in terms of job creation and income production, the strategic investment program has, the rural areas haven't fully participated to date. And so some degree of flexibility to take into account this, the aspirational development that, that some of these areas have to make, I think is a good idea, you know, in terms of the specific policy aside. So thank you. Those that's all I have for prepared comments. But again, the written comments go into a little bit more detail.
Thank you. Any questions for Mark? Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the analysis, and thank you for emphasizing the plight of my rural counties and others. The question here, I suppose, would be, in attracting businesses any place in Oregon, is should we be doing things that make it more expensive for business to locate here, regardless of whether it's in a rural or an urban area? Because what's happened, obviously, is that because of the twist in the law as written, we've allowed businesses to locate in newly expanded urban areas, newly designated urban areas, at a lower cost, and maybe attracting the business to Oregon as opposed to, let's say, Washington. So my question to you is, by trying to assist rural counties, which are have many problems that exceed many times the value of this device, like distance and remoteness and cost and few people and all the things that I'm very familiar with, are we, in fact, damaging the ability to attract business to, let's say, our more prosperous urban areas by virtue of not being as competitive against, let's say, Washington?
Representative Vance, Chairman Barnhart, that is a concern. Economists call it tax competition, and it's certainly both across states and counties and countries has become much more intense over the past 20 years. And to a certain extent, obviously these things can go too far. But in terms of rural Oregon, as you mentioned, access is the most important thing, and infrastructure is of paramount importance. Getting goods and people to these areas a lot of times is really the only path forward to making them competitive. And to the extent that we can get this started with public investments, which may well be subsidized, but get it kick-started and get us onto a trajectory of growth where the private enterprises in these areas can take over, I think there is some hope to do it without where all everyone becomes better off. Obviously, it makes our whole the state better off when these areas have less need for our public services. So I think to the extent that we can seed some more organic growth in these areas, that's a win-win.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is the tax policy we've been discussing the most important reason why a business chooses to park itself in one spot rather than another? Or are there other issues that are likely to be more important?
Yeah, Representative Barnhart, in terms of the overall cost structure of firms, labor costs and energy costs and rent costs dominate our tax costs. But that said, at the margin, obviously, tax rates do matter. And we've certainly seen that with the sort of firms that are have been moving to our state in the last 10 or 20 years. We've seen that tax rates do certainly matter. You know, broadly, there are a lot of things that firms worry about when they make their location decisions.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for Mark? Yes, bus please.
Thanks, Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Mark, I just wanted to thank you for coming today. I knew that I was smart enough to know that any of the deep questions I wasn't able to answer, he would be able to handle. So thanks so much for being here.
Yes, and let me add my thanks to that as well. I know you're busy on what you're going to bring us soon, and we appreciate your coming today. Thank you. So let's go on and hear from Keith and Sarah. Who would like to go first?
Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Keith Peel. I am the current chair of the Public Policy Committee at the Hillsborough Chamber of Commerce, and I represent the chamber today. The Hillsborough Chamber of Commerce strongly opposes House Bill 4142, which would amend the state's strategic investment program by reducing the applicability of the rural SIP. This legislation would directly impact the ability of Hillsborough and other communities to create new, high-paying manufacturing jobs. The Oregon economy has improved markedly since the depths of the Great Recession, and yet we are still lagging the nation's economy and employment figures. Oregon's personal income per capita is 90% of the national average, down from 102% in 1979 and 97% in the mid-90s. This is a disturbing long-term trend. As a state, we are operating in a very competitive environment. Many states have discretionary funds and can write big checks to lure new industrial development. Oregon does not have those kinds of resources. As a result, programs like the SIP are essential if we are to stay competitive for new large-scale manufacturing investment. Importantly, these programs do not require the expenditure of public funds. They merely entail the foregoing of property tax revenues for a prescribed period of time. The rural SIP was an important factor in Genentech's approximately $300 million investment in Hillsborough, which has resulted in nearly 300 high-paying jobs. The Hillsborough Chamber is disappointed that a legislative approach has once again been sought. We do not believe that it would be appropriate or prudent for the legislature to pit one Oregon community against one another. We firmly believe that any job that is gained or retained is a direct benefit to all Oregon citizens and communities. Creating barriers for any one community potentially harms all others. Now is not the time to look at removing or diminishing any of the limited tools that we offer as incentives to business. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Garrison. I'm the Economic Development Manager for the City of Hillsborough, and I would also like to express my strong opposition to House Bill 4142. It does remove a tool from our economic development toolbox. It also does pit Hillsborough against some other rural communities, which in reality, the projects that we're competing for are on a national and a global scale. It's not against Coos Bay or other communities. What this does is takes a tool away from Hillsborough and from other communities in Oregon like Bend, Medford, Kaiser, Corvallis that could potentially use this tool in the future. The opportunities to use it are rare. We've only used it once for the Genentech project, and it wasn't us against somebody else. It was us against Texas, who could write a $40 million check out of their governor's fund, and we couldn't. So the tool, the tax tool that we used for them, helped narrow that gap and allow them to make a decision to where they really wanted to locate. I think any job in Oregon, whether it's in Hillsborough or in one of the rural communities, benefits all of us. So we would strongly oppose this. I don't think the removal, the effectively limiting the use of the rural SIP in many of these communities throughout Oregon helps any of us in the long run, especially when we need the economic robust recovery. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. I would simply note that we're also dealing, I think, in the Senate now with bills on the issue of gain share and how that's managed. And I think these two issues sort of intertwine, so I'll simply note that. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2142, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4004.
You said 21.
Yes, we're closing the public hearing on 4142, and we open a public hearing on House Bill 4004. Thank you. I'm going to screw up a lot. all day.
Chris.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4004 is being referred to as the technical fix bill. And in OLIS, there is a dash 2 amendment and a dash 3 amendment. And the reason for the two amendments is that one of them pertains to technical fixes from the regular session. That's the dash 2. And the dash 3 pertains to technical fixes from the special session bill. So what I've tried to do, I've taken a new approach this time.
Dangerous.
You get to be the judge if it works or not. Under meeting materials, there's a handout that I put together that contains a few tables to try and...
Nothing's available.
Nothing's
yeah.
We can see it. We don't like this approach.
It's not there.
I'm logged in, and I'm working. It's working fine, so it may be that we have to make it public. I'm not sure.
We're all logged in.
You're all logged in. Yep. Okay.
I think I'm in.
Yeah. What's your name up there?
I got to it from the page.
That's where I was.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, well, this is off to a good start.
We're off to a good start. Why don't you go ahead and describe your document, and we can start working on figuring out how to get the other members up on it.
The description of the document, there are three tables in it, one for the introduced bill, one for the dash 2, one for the dash 3, and it contains either line number references or section references lined up with the policy and then with the clarification, and it's up on the screen right now. So I guess working from that while we're trying to get it fixed so it gets populated into OLIS. So just working through this, again, trying to cross the bridge between going line by line through the amendments in the bill and then focusing on the policy, or not the policy pieces, but the clarifications. In Section 1 of the introduced bill, this pertains to the medical subtraction, and there are two changes. One is just a clarification of an IRC reference. The drafted bill, it was too specific. And then that second change, what I've referred to as the phase-out bracket, there is a kind of no-man's land for the phase-out of the medical subtraction. As you recall, it's either $1,800 or $1,400 or $1,000, depending on the income level. And for the $1,000 level, there is a no-man's land, so to speak, of people with income of either $100,000 or $200,000. They wouldn't be affected. It has to do with a less than or less than or equal to kind of mathematical.
Got it.
In Section 2 of the introduced bill pertains to the IC disk, and the way the bill read, there were three policies related to the IC disk. There was a 2.5% tax imposed, and then there was a deduction and a subtraction, and we'll get to some of those other pieces a little bit later. But the way the bill read, the 2.5% tax applied to all IC disks, and the policy intent was that it applied only to IC disks that had been formed prior to 1/1/2014. In the Section 3, pertains to cigarette taxes, and there was an omission of a subsection reference. And so this just makes sure that, that those revenues go to the general fund, which was the policy intent. Section 4 pertains to the non-passive income policy. And as you recall, one of the key requirements for taxpayers to take advantage of those lower rates was that they materially participate in the business. In the drafted language, there was a day-to-day operations language that didn't quite align with the federal definitions of material participation. This just removes those words, day-to-day operations. And in the fifth section of the introduced bill, there is a section which is standard language when tax policy gets changes that allows the Department of Revenue to waive penalty and interest if they are the result of the tax changes in that bill. That section didn't have an applicability, so it granted too much authority to the Department of Revenue to waive penalty and interest. This change just limits it to tax year 2013. Because the tax law changed in October of 2013, so it was quite possible that somebody might have underpaid tax due to those changes. This just says if that was the case, then DOR has the authority to waive the penalty and interest.
Okay.
So that's the base bill. The Dash 2 amendment pertains to a couple of technical pieces from the regular session that were missed for one reason or another. There are three sections. This Section 2, the reason they refer to Section 6, 7, and 8, they're just amended at the bottom of the bill. So the first one pertains to non-resident income from Oregon sources, and it was originally in House Bill 2512, and it literally just changes the word on to in. It has to do with the waterway. It's a Columbia River thing. So it says it goes from on the water to in the water. Section 7 is the reporting of penalties. This was House Bill 2464. And the way the bill read, it applied a penalty to a number of reports required by the Department of Revenue, but it was only supposed to be applicable to W-2s. So this just limits, it deletes the old language and replaces it, clarifying that the penalty only applies to W-2s. Under prior law, people weren't, DOR was requesting the W-2s, but there was no penalty if employers didn't provide them. This was the penalty piece. And then the applicability there in Section 8 just applies to tax years 2014 moving forward.
The applicability for...
Those two changes,
thank you.
Right. Just to make sure, no, that's fine. And just to make sure I understand, we're not actually changing the penalty provisions. We're simply applying them correctly.
Correct. Yes, exactly.
Okay. I mean, I see the language on page 4 and 5 where you delete it in one place and then you add it back again, but I presume in a more specific way.
The prior language referred to the entire section.
Right.
And there is another subsection that includes quarterly reports provided to the Department of Revenue.
Okay.
So the penalty caught up would have applied to those quarterly reports, which was not the intent.
Right.
It has to do with annual reports for...
Yeah, we're talking about 1099s, basically, aren't we?
And W-2s, yeah.
And thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay, the Dash 3, which replaced the Dash 1, if anybody was wondering about that, refers to the special session bill. And here, I'm trying to come up with an easy way to link the language there to the goal of the changes. The first couple lines are just bill header, and then the rest of page 1, lines 4 to 22, and then the top of page 6, all pertain to the IC disk. And there are a number of small issues that have come up with the IC disk, and so the amendments look really complicated. The goal of it and the intent of the policy was to unify this 2.5% tax on the IC disks. Under prior law, the IC disks were not recognized by the state.
That's right.
So they just didn't exist as far as state tax was concerned. This policy established a deduction for exporters who made commission payments to IC disks. So they got a deduction for those payments, and the IC disks had to pay a 2.5% tax on those payments. And then when the IC disk remitted commission payments back to the exporter, then the exporter gets a subtraction for those dividend payments. Basically, the exporter makes commission payments to the IC disk, and then the IC disk makes dividend payments back to the exporter. In federal law, there are incentives for all pieces of that transaction, and so what Oregon law now does is kind of piggybacks on those in a slightly different manner. So the money that goes to the IC disk is subject to a 2.5% tax. The entity that made the payment gets a deduction for those payments, and when the money comes back to the exporter, they are allowed a subtraction.
That's federal.
Federal law is conceptually it's the mechanisms are a little bit different. But at federal law, that's what they do. And now Oregon law does the same thing in a slightly different way. The policy intent was for all of these to be aligned.
Right. That's right.
A couple of the problems, and if, for example, the subtractions, and in the dash 3, if you wanted to look at lines specifically 13 through 15, the way it was drafted, or the way it read, the subtraction applied to all IC disks. And the policy intent was it only all of these transactions, all of these incentives applied to IC disks that were formed before January 1st of 2014. So since the subtraction would apply to all IC disks, potentially somebody could have formed an IC disk in 2016 and they wouldn't have been subject to the tax. The deduction wouldn't have been allowed, but the subtraction would have been allowed. So it's an asymmetry among the three policies. Other aspects of that, the starting point for this was tax year 2013. Other potential problems came up with commission payments and being made in 2013, but that didn't necessarily mean that the taxpayer either making those payments or receiving them, it was their tax year 2013. It's a fiscal year calendar year problem. For example, if you had an exporter who was on a fiscal year ending in October and the IC disk had a calendar year, there could have been a payment made in August. And the way the bill read, the tax would have applied to the payment going to the IC disk because it was their tax year 2013, but the exporter, they were in tax year 2012. So they wouldn't have gotten the deduction. And I could flip that around where the deduction would have been allowed and the tax would not have been imposed. So these kinds of asymmetries, and this is why I've tried to represent it this way. Anybody who's brave enough to try and piece it together, and I'm sure all the members, you'll want to do that to just confirm everything.
Can't wait, Chris.
That's a wonderful assertion.
Hold on, give me a second.
Can you draw?
I assume that LC agrees with you about this. I drafted it accordingly.
We have had many conversations.
That sounds like it.
And we think it works, but everybody gets to do it.
Well, the one thing, in fairness, the bill was drafted very quickly. In a special session, we didn't allow LC the time to actually that they would have needed to actually track every bit of this through. And what you're doing now is trying to do the cleanup, so that what we thought we were doing in October turns out to be the actuality in February, I think.
Yes, that's the goal.
Okay, and the other thing I would add that I think everyone on the committee knows, and probably everyone in our audience knows, is that every tax law change takes at least three bills before you figure out what all the wrinkles are, and this is only number two. So expect at least one more, maybe two or three more later to finish up getting it fixed. Questions for Chris? Did you finish? Or am I interrupting too early?
I can be finished if you want. There are...
I think you better continue and go ahead. Because I don't want someone later on to say we didn't hear the rest of Chris's explanation.
The key thing about this is that the tax, the deduction, and the subtraction are meant to apply together. Part of the tricky piece is that it can involve two or three or more taxpayers. And the whole point is that deduction is only allowed if the tax is paid and the subtraction is allowed, and working through all combinations. All three of these incentives apply or none of them apply.
I think we've also learned this morning why accountants, despite their best efforts to simplify our tax law, still have plenty of business.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we help them in that.
We help them in that regard
we
constantly.
We help them in that.
Okay. Questions? Other questions? I'm sorry.
I'll be quick.
Keep going. Yeah.
The last three technical pieces pertain to the non-passive income policy.
Yes.
The first one there, we now add language that specifically ties material participation to the definition in IRC, just straight up. The second piece clarifies that the incentive applies to Oregon-sourced income. And the last piece, the way the bill read was that the base case for law is that the taxpayers would take advantage of the preferential rates, and at their election, they would not take the preferential rates, which is kind of a backwards way to view tax law. And so that last piece just says, no, the base case is you don't take it, but if you want to, you can.
So it's an opt-in rather than an opt-out.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
That makes a lot of sense. Yes, Representative Berger.
Questions.
Please go ahead.
Questions, and I'll be brief because, as many know, I objected strongly to doing this kind of complex tax policy in a special session in one day, and I am not surprised to be here making very difficult corrections on a tax policy that only impacts a very few Oregonians. So now that I've got that on the books, let me ask Chris if. Yesterday's discussion about Department of Revenue and their course system replacement, and I hope that these discussions with between you, LC, have included the Department of Revenue and their ability to do this in the time frames while they are in the midst of a course system replacement project that is far more important to a lot of us than in light of our IT conversion history. And so please assure me that the Department of Revenue is in on these discussions and understands and is going to be able to respond.
Co-Chair Berger, they are involved in every step
of
the discussions.
Thank you. Do we have any witnesses?
Nobody wanted to talk.
Representative Vince.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Chris, for all this really important work. The link to of material participation to the Internal Revenue Code definition, extremely important. I'm very happy to see it. Were there other definitions that we're going alone on, or are we consistent pretty much with the code throughout this new piece of legislation?
Representative Benz, we try to be consistent. So this was the biggest issue, and the discussions last fall were that just simply using the terms material participation was sufficient to tie to federal. And there were discussions about whether or not there needed to be an explicit tie. At the time, the bill landed the way it was, and this bill and amendment contained two slight fixes, the day-to-day operation language, and then specifically just saying in statute, material participation means what the IRC says in 469.
Thank you for that. Thank you.
Representative Davis and then Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Chair. And Chris, could you enlighten us on who and how these inconsistencies and technical difficulties were identified? And I'll lead that question by saying I don't think it was just you or revenue in a box or ledge counsel, but I received emails from tax practitioners who know I'm on the revenue committee and said, hey, we're working with our clients right now, and what's in this bill doesn't seem to make sense. Help us figure this out. And many of those communications were forwarded on to the revenue office.
Representative Davis, that's correct. It's a lot of people from exactly what you described, members forwarding emails. We talked to CPAs for a variety of reasons. They raised them up. There's some tax lawyers who have raised issues. It's a variety of many people.
Thank you.
And the fact that we have a lack of the CPA organization to testify today suggests to me that we're getting closer in terms of dealing with the confusion issue. Other questions for Chris? I am hoping to work this bill very soon, so if you have additional questions, please get in touch with him and me right away. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4004. Representative Unger, you're here for which bill? 4141. I think we'll open that one then. Open House Bill 4141 for public hearing.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the
committee.
Excuse
me, just a moment. Let's hear from LC and from LRO, and then it'll be your turn.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4141 would change some of the, or most of the property tax exemptions, actually, to remove property tax revenue that would go to schools or education service districts from the various property tax exemptions. And this includes most of the property tax exemptions, including the SIP, enterprise zones, FCC licenses, fraternal and religious organizations, cemeteries, and many, many others. So this would represent approximately a little bit less than 40% of the revenue that, would go to these schools or education service districts if these exemptions were removed.
Thank you. Now it's your turn.
Thank you, Chair. And I have some comments on...
Would you introduce yourself?
My name is Ben Unger. I'm the state representative for House District 29, representing Western Washington County. I have a PowerPoint that I made that's on OLIS, but I'm not going to follow it in particularly, although there's some interesting facts on there if you want to look at it. And in a complex bill like this, I guess you could go through and start to try to talk about all the different tax breaks that are included here. As you can see in the 31 pages of a bill, probably not the best way to use our time. So I thought that it'd be better just to talk a little bit about why I introduced this bill and the conversation that I'm hoping to have. The plight of our school funding woes is, I think, a much visited topic in this building. We struggle all the time to try to figure out how we can do a better job of funding our schools. And over the last year or so, as we've been in this building, we've had a bunch of different proposals that have made a dent. And in the special session that we were just discussing fixing, made a dent in some of the problems we have with getting more teachers into the classroom. The problem is that we still have such a long ways to go. If you look at the quality education model, we're still $1.9 billion short of where our schools need to be in order for us to give our kids and our communities the quality education they deserve. And that shortfall will not be easily made up. So we have some tough discussions ahead, and I know that I appreciate the governor's leadership in walking us into a revenue reform discussion about how we are going to close that gap and the other gaps that we see. And one of the pieces that I wanted to make sure was that at the top of that discussion, that list, was the death by a thousand paper cuts tax break system that we have in our school districts, where we lose hundreds of millions of dollars of biennium because of the property tax breaks that our school districts face, that they oftentimes have no say over, that have a dramatic impact on the quality education that we can provide. If you just look at the local property tax breaks, if you just look at what local governments can do, school districts in this biennium, and this is an estimate from the Legislative Revenue Office, lost out on $378.8 million of school district money. This is money that the school districts didn't get a chance to say, we need that money. It's not money that the state got to say, we ought to put that money into schools. There were decisions made by folks who were well-intentioned in trying to build the economic development of the state, but they weren't the folks responsible for helping make sure that we have quality schools. I believe if we're going to have a strong economy in the state, we need strong schools. And I think the debate that we'll have here over the next half an hour or so is going to be a discussion of the but-for that Chair Barnhart brought up before. If we didn't do these breaks, would we not have any jobs in the state at all? Will be the question. And I think there are a lot of these breaks that actually do meet their intended purpose. They create a lot of jobs. I think there are a lot of these breaks that don't. Do the urban renewal district tax breaks that we create that take hundreds of millions of dollars out of schools, do they create more jobs than just putting teachers into the classroom? I think you'd be hard-pressed to say that they do. Clearly this bill, in its current form, probably won't pass. Needs a couple of amendments. but I do think that we need to look at our school district dollars differently and have a discussion about what kind of state we want to be and what kind of states we want to compete with. And one of the earlier speakers talking about a different bill was talking about how we were competing with Texas over a Genentech facility that's out actually in Washington County.
And I think one of the questions that we actually have to ask is Texas going to be our competitor state, or are we going to try to compete with the states that have made different choices, that have invested in education, that have invested in kind of the quality communities that I think Oregon is about? And I hope that we can start to protect school district dollars, that we can find some of these breaks that aren't working, where we know that $100,000 into a classroom is going to do a better job of helping our communities than $100,000 out the door uncollected into a tax break. So I am happy to answer any questions. Clearly, if we want to, we can go line by line through the bill. But I appreciate the time to bring this important issue forward, and happy to stick around and see what comes next.
Thank you. Colleagues, we'll take questions. I will know I have 17 people signed up to be heard. I'm going to ask them to limit their testimony to as short as they can make it in order to get done today. My request to Representative Unger is that he ought to go ahead and prepare the amendments he thinks we need so that the committee has a chance to actually consider the bill. I'm certainly not going to pass a bill that you tell us isn't ready. But any questions for, or at least on the concept that Representative Unger presents to us today? Thank you very much. We really appreciate your testimony.
And we are preparing those amendments, and they should be ready very, very soon.
Thank you.
Wanted to have this discussion first before we move forward. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. All right. I'm going to ask people to limit their remarks to as briefly as possible to make the key points they want to make. We do have a bunch of documents. I'll ask the committee to read those documents. I see people have been pretty good at marking pro and con. I'm going to take some pros first and then some cons, and we'll try to alternate a bit. Kate Grandusky, Janine Solman, Laurie Wimmer, please. And I'm going to run the timer on you, but please be as brief as you can manage, because we have a lot to do today and a lot of people who like to be heard. Please.
Okay. Good morning. Thank you for hearing me. My name is Kate Grandusky. I'm a school board member. I'm a retired teacher. And I'm from Gales Creek, and our 152-year-old community school was closed because of lack of funding. It devastated our community. I did tie myself, and I think I can do it in 3 minutes. I am here to support Ben's Bill 4141, creating lockbox for education allocated dollars, which should be attractive to fiscal conservatives, Republicans, and Democrats alike, because education dollars are our most important tax dollar investment. We are all aware that the 21st century has been challenging with two wars, recession, high unemployment, and the swelling of the numbers of individuals in poverty. The children of Oregon have also been significantly impacted by these challenges. Our teachers and communities have continued through these difficult years with a firm commitment to put in more time and commitment to our next generation of learners with less dollars, teachers, and resources. While we continue to hear the steady drumbeat of negative journalism and criticism from the new reformers about the failure of public schools. And
excuse me, are you reading a document?
Yeah.
Do we have that document? I think we do. Could you summarize your document rather than reading it? And I'll ask the members to read it.
The biggest crisis in education is not only not enough resources, but we have poverty. We have inequality with the education of our different schools. In Forest Grove, we have a huge number of minorities, over 50%. The cuts in the last 5 years have been tremendous. And with the not only the cuts, but also the mandates with the Common Core and everything that comes from the state and the federal government, there are not dollars to continue doing what we're doing. I volunteer 2 days a week in the school systems. Most of the classes are over 30. At the high school level, they're over 40 students, and in some cases, 50 students. We cannot have the workforce that we need in our state of Oregon and be a viable economic community without funding for our students. My biggest concern is that our kids don't have the resources that they need. Right now, we are not even providing mathematic books for our students. It's 2 years out. So please read my outline that I have of my concerns, because it's nutrition, it's poverty, it's early intervention that we need for kids, some of the same things the governor is concerned about. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Chair Barnhart and Vice Chairs Bailey Berger and members of the Revenue Committee, my name is Janine Salmon. I am a parent of two boys, one in college and one in high school. And I am a member of the Hillsborough School Board. I've been reelected to my fifth year in this position.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm here today to provide personal testimony today, and I'm not here representing the voice of the entire Hillsborough School Board. I just want to make that clear. I'm very fortunate to live in Hillsborough, an area where the city's mission statement includes fostering collaborative partnerships to enhance Hillsborough's hometown
livability. And again,
livability.
Let me repeat. It looks to me like you're reading from this document
okay.
that we already have. If you could give us the high points in your testimony, and I'll ask the members of the committee to read the material you've given us.
Okay. Okay, my high points, I would just like to say that we provide a service to 20,000 plus students to make sure that they have options for career and college readiness, and we have great partnerships with our city leadership, with our county partners, agencies, and our Chamber of Commerce and so on. But we have situations where we need help more. We have situations in our elementary schools, and I'll give you the example, just the one example that I stated, a third-grade classroom with 31 students, Mrs. White's third-grade classroom. And she has varying educational needs. I mean, she has students that have six students that have intensified learning. Then she has five students that are English language learners. And third grade is a benchmark year, so where you're looking at we're held accountable through various means, such as the test scores and the attendance of our students and maintaining the highly effective teachers. So we're charged with that, but we have these barriers in place all across our district with our elementary schools, our high school classrooms. We have AP science classrooms that have to readjust their lesson plans due to the size of the room and how many students they have for safety reasons. And I just My hope is that this bill is a catalyst that really creates a larger conversation around funding and making sure that our schools become considered an essential service, such as cemeteries. I just find that so incredibly odd that we value and think about those and respect their afterlife, but we don't think about the kids that are currently in school for the future. And I think that schools really do need to be considered an essential service. So I appreciate the time. I will look forward to further conversation on this, and hopefully you all know that the urgency is now. The urgency is great, and we ask that we just really have a serious conversation about that tax reform.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association, also chair of the Oregon Revenue Coalition. And it will come as no shock to you that we are here in support of the concept behind House Bill 4141, as we have for many years argued that in order to balance budgets and adequately fund our number one economic driver, which is our public education system in this state, we definitely have to have the revenues sufficient to the goal. And those goals have been heightened with higher standards, greater testing, and so forth over the years. You know that. But at the same time that we've ramped up the rigor and drawn the line higher in the sky for all kids to achieve, we have diminished our budgets. And while the 2013 legislature did its best to close some of that hole, we still have nearly a $2 billion hole toward with respect to adequacy. And to me, there's a real disconnect between giving the tax breaks on one hand and demanding higher accountability and higher achievement on the other with ever smaller budgets. That just doesn't pencil out, and I know all of you were A students in math. So you have my written testimony. I will be brief in deference to the chair's request, but I would like to make a couple very quick points. The $378 million of foregone revenue the school's portion of the local revenue in this current biennium translates to $670 out of the pockets of every school child in Oregon in this biennium, $670. And I think that's an important notion to think about. And the other point I would make is the reason I say every child in Oregon is that even if one were to confer some kind of veto authority on a local school district in a county considering issuing a SIP, for example, or another sort of tax break of that ilk, that they would be in the position of making a decision that impacts students everywhere, and that's because our state school fund offsets the local revenue, as you all know, and so that loss is spread across the state and in every district. We experience that loss, so the negotiation and decisions of one school district impact 197 and the students they serve. And as you've heard from the previous two witnesses, these students have lost their beloved teachers in hundreds in some district. We have one science teacher who testified last year on our class size bill that he had one class of 58 science students and another class of 60. 58 and 60. He can't do the science labs that are required for the kind of rigor that we are demanding because it's simply not safe. The budget for this current biennium reduced it, so I think he's down to 52 now. So that's real progress. but I think that the lockbox concept is superior to the idea of granting limited authority to a local school district in these considerations, and that we need to balance the economic needs that we have in terms of the inducements through our tax policy with the economic engine that the schools provide and economists demonstrate we provide to the state of Oregon. We do want to raise the lake to float all boats, but we think there's more than one way to do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. We very much appreciate your testimony. Keith Peel, Roger Beyer, Tracy Liske, please. On deck, Louise Curran, Chuck Riley, and Jody Weiser. Please go ahead.
Good morning again, Mr. Chairman. Again, Keith Peel here today representing the Hillsborough Chamber of Commerce. As you know, Washington County, State of Oregon, has had great success in delivering a positive environment for job growth, creation, and retention. And these jobs generate a huge amount of revenue to pay for our important public services, our roads, our teachers, firefighters, et cetera. They also support many of our local businesses, providing additional jobs in our community, et cetera. The legislation
Let me just say again that when you pass out a document
I'm using
like
it as
this,
as a highlight document.
That would be great. I appreciate that. Thank you.
I'm following, but making it brief for you.
Thank you.
And the legislation before you in House Bill 4141 really truly threatens that partnership because it undoes the great things that strategic investment have made and tax abatement have made to our business community. They have been a huge success for the state. If you look at the hundreds or thousands of jobs that have been created, particularly in Washington County, if we look at Intel and Genentech, which we've talked about today, those jobs were created directly as a result of tax abatement. The Chamber opposes 4141. It attacks the limited programs that we have in the toolbox. Mr. Unger's intentions are poor here. Killing the economic generators of our state's economy will not fund schools. We hope Representative Unger seriously appreciates and considers.
Representative Bailey?
I appreciate the testimony from the witness. I would ask you to please refrain from impugning the character of a fellow member. And stating his intentions.
Duly noted.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That's really my job, and I should have said that myself. When people are testifying in a committee, one of the House rules is that we don't assume motives of members. We don't assume that we understand all of the reasons why they bring something. We certainly don't impugn their motivation. So please go ahead with that in mind.
As a representative of Hillsborough, we felt, though, that it was clear to articulate to this committee the chamber's strong opposition to Mr. Unger's proposal. This does not represent the opinion of the Hillsborough Chamber, our 800-plus business members representing a cross-section of 50,000 employees. We wanted to go on the record to make sure that we clearly were in objection to that. This is the wrong approach to solving a real problem. We can figure out how to fund our important public services. We oppose 4141, and the chamber is wide open to having real discussion on how the state can continue to grow jobs. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. Excuse me. I'm here representing the Oregon Seed Council, the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, and the Oregon Blueberry Commission. I'd like to start out by pointing out that something you probably all know, but tax exemptions are very different than tax credits. Tax credits are used to give a shot in the arm, a one-time benefit to an industry or a program, where tax exemptions are used and designed to implement to ensure that industries can move forward and survive over the long term. And this bill is dealing with tax exemptions, not tax credits. Farm and forest has been the backbone of Oregon's economy, and these tax exemptions that they have been offered, many of them date back to the 50s or 70s or earlier, some as early as 1957, I believe, was the earliest of these tax exemptions for the farm industry. But we need these tax exemptions in order to move forward in a hopefully profitable way, because we deal with a crop that this bill would tax that crop, a lot of which will never get to market. We have no control over the pricing of that crop. We are price takers, not price setters. We have no ability to pass on an increase in tax, because we don't get to determine the price of our product. The tax exemption is also on the perishable goods. In many cases, you're talking about fruit, berries, milk. I guess cheese and butter are milk into a non-perishable product, but these are all subject to this tax. So we have no control over things such as weather, growing seasons, insects, diseases. So we could be paying tax on a product that, due to the issues out of our control, we have no chance to ever recoup that money. So with that, I will, as in my attempt to be brief, I will close only with saying the most recent report from the Department of Revenue on tax expenditures, which these are in, the Department of Revenue states these exemptions are successfully accomplishing the goals they have been implemented to achieve. So I think that pretty well describes it. And some of the other things, in addition to what I've already mentioned, you've got seeds, farm machinery, farm equipment, standing timber, irrigation equipment. So there's lots of things that our members use, and decisions are made by these tax exemptions. So we oppose the bill and urge you not to move forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and fellow members. My name is Tracy Liske. Just for the record, I do sit on the Board of Ag, but I'm not speaking for the Board of Agriculture. And I am a fourth-generation farmer in the Klamath Basin. I'm also first vice president of Oregon Farm Bureau. We raise cattle, hay, grain, nursery stock, and I'm speaking in opposition to this bill. Even though agriculture is the second largest income revenue, farming is a very risky business. As Roger said, we deal with Mother Nature, changing markets, and government regulations on a daily basis, and I think Mother Nature is going to be our worst enemy this year. Because the most farmers work on a very small margin of profit, and some years no profit at all, these are the reasons under current law, personal property tax for farmers and farmer operations such as machinery, farm equipment, products, annual and perennial plants and crops, and irrigation equipment are exempt from annual personal property tax. Tax exemptions are designed and implemented to ensure that our industry is important to society and stable and has the ability to succeed. Farming is the backbone of Oregon's economy since the founding and deserves to be given these tax exemption status. These are long-standing established exemptions, as Roger talked about, dating back to 1950 and the 70s. Farmers rely on these tax exemptions because of the nature of agriculture and its expensive equipment we need to succeed to be a global farmer. Many farmers, like myself, will harvest crops in the summer and fall and sell them next year. This is due to the markets and pricing. Under this legislation, if I were unable to sell my crop directly after harvest, I would have to pay a property tax on it, and then, when I sell it, pay an income tax on it. Agriculture equipment is exempt because of seasonal use. As an example, a combine will cost over $200,000 and may be only used 2 to 3 weeks a year. The record keeping and data collection required by this bill for farmers would be enormous, and as Roger stated, that the Oregon Department of Revenue states these exemptions are working very complicated. So for these reasons, I would encourage you not to pass this bill.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony. I already mentioned Lois, Chuck, and Jody. On deck, Douglas Schmidt, Bob Vroman, and Doris Penwell. Go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name for the record is Chuck Riley. I'm actually the former representative of House District 29, and I want to say that I'm very pleased with the current representative of my district. It's being very ably represented. This bill is an example of that. This is a very good bill. I think if you talked with any of the teachers, you've heard from some superintendents, teachers, school board members, and if you talk to any of those or any of the parents of any of the students in most of the schools, you would discover that they would much prefer that this money goes to the schools instead of to corporations. I believe that, you know, this is unlike Representative Hunger, I believe that this bill in its current form is a very good bill, and I'm sure it'll be better with his amendments that he's going to bring forward. I urge you to move this bill forward with or without the amendments, and I'm going to keep it extremely brief, as it, you know, is my way of speaking. So that's all I have. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer those.
Thank you very much. Lady.
Hello, my name is Louise Curran, and I am a retired secretary from Portland Public Schools and a resident of Aloha, Oregon, and a proud parent of an Aloha High School graduate. As a secretary for Portland Public Schools, I've witnessed over the years larger and larger class sizes, exempting corporations from paying property taxes that otherwise would go to schools is hurting Oregon students. All stakeholders need to take part in supporting education. If Oregon children do not get the education they need, businesses will not have what they need in turn to succeed, a well-trained workforce. One of the things that I find very startling is the fact that we have 500 less teachers now than we had in 2000 in the year 2000, and we have many more students. We need to make sure that vital school dollars that belong to schools are not being given away, and those schools have the input on how those funds are being used. I urge you to consider what these dollars are worth to the future generations of Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Jody?
Jody Weiser for Tax Fairness Oregon. So I want to just make a few points off of the pages that you'll have from me. One is that the bill excludes protecting the funding for community colleges, and that's something that we would choose to amend in because that educational piece of our community is important. We noticed that the bill runs 31 pages, and it's really a compendium of history of what different industries have gotten year after year after year, and it adds up to a lot when you kind of total it all. Since many people in the legislature don't have much experience in the legislature, they probably don't know what's already been given to many of the industries that are listed. And so it might be a good reading thing for all new legislators coming in. We thought when we heard about this bill that it would address only enterprise zones and urban renewal districts. And so we were surprised to see all of the things and the broader stroke that this bill takes. I do think that this is probably the best jobs bill you will have this session before you, because a lot of things would have to be assessed, which currently aren't assessed. Those would be good public service jobs, and they would also probably, if you consider it long enough, employ a lot of lobbyists to be here for every one of the businesses who yes. have received exemptions in the past. We would recommend two possible smaller bills that address part of what this bill does. One would be to just look at the enterprise zones and urban renewal districts, putting in the term enterprise zones, the strategic investment program, and the strategic investment zones, since that's the largest of the enterprise zones that we have. Clearly, it would be easy enough to do it with those businesses because they are already assessed. And if you took those dollars back from the gifts, it would make quite a difference, probably about $150 to $165 million, which would buy 7.5 days of school. Alternatively, the way the SIP law reads, a business gets taxed in at least two and sometimes as many as four ways. One piece of it is based on property value, either $25 million in a rural area or $100 million in an urban area, and that money is distributed the way taxes are always distributed. A larger amount generally comes in as a community service fee. That money is not distributed in the way it's normally distributed. It goes to the city and the county, and they can decide what to do with it. I was told last night by someone from the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue that they got $50,000.
Gainshare
also is not distributed. So another solution that would be fairly simple would be for you to make a decision that these things that are currently not distributed as property taxes would be, and that would return a good bit of money to the school districts.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Douglas, Bob, and Doris, and on deck, Sean Gillians, Chris Fick, and Ellen Miller, please.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the president of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, better known as OSACA. As this bill is written, we would have to oppose it, not because of its base of providing it more money for education, but because of the complexity of implementing this bill. You've heard a lot of people talk about the different exemptions that would be affected, crops, timber. How would we handle enterprise zones with the different MAVs? And so, to be very brief, we believe that this bill would be very difficult to implement. We don't have the staff, we don't have the expertise to value some of the things that are mentioned, and that but I would offer that we would be happy to review the amendments that Representative Unger is submitting, and if necessary, if he would like, we would be happy to work with him to try and create a bill that would achieve the goals that he's looking at.
And that you could administer.
And that we can administer, that is correct.
Thank you. He's sitting right behind you. I think that's an excellent suggestion. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Bob Vroman. I'm the Clackamas County Assessor, also here as a member of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, and I'll be again brief for your purposes. You've actually heard a lot of good discussion this morning, and I think if there's something that is positive about this bill, it is that this discussion is taking place. Mm-hmm. The bill in its current form would be almost impossible for us to administer. The scope is extremely broad, and this committee has experience in dealing with the senior deferral program changes. To make a change that would be this magnitude in this period of time.
You know how to get us, don't you?
I say that because of your earnest work on trying to actually save and continue a very positive program. And I think that's what we're talking about here. We're often asked, how do you fix the property tax system? Well, this bill does not help us fix a property tax system. The correct question is, how do we fix our tax system in general, which might provide some of the solutions that are being brought to you today? So again, we're very willing to work not only with Representative Unger, but with the legislature to have that discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Doris Penwell. I represent the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm here today to testify in opposition to House Bill 4141. We have talked to Representative Unger, and we truly appreciate the purpose and intent behind his proposal, because, for one thing, local officials across the state have a close and vested interest in funding schools in their jurisdictions, and as I've talked to some of those people, they think they spend half their time worrying about that issue. But the bill before you actually is a major change to the tax system, and because of the major impacts it would have on practically every walk of life, it frankly would still not fix what we have as a problem system in Oregon for taxing. We have a very inequitable property tax system, which is assessed at the local level, not the state level, and we still wouldn't have been fixing anything other than some help for schools. One thing that we've been involved in for many years is local choice for use of business incentives, and those aren't uniform across the state. These programs are in statute. They can be used or not used at the local level. But when these local officials working with their schools decide to use one of these incentives to do something for their long-term future, it is very well thought out. I doubt that there is anybody in the state that doesn't care about the impact on those schools and their future. So, I have submitted testimony. I don't need to go into great detail, except to say that this is much more far-reaching than what we would be capable of doing during this short session, and I appreciate your attention to this issue, as always.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony very much. Sean, Chris, and Ellen, and then Tracy Smith and Cappy Eaton, please. And is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning? I hesitate to ask the question. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians today representing the Oregon Economic Development Association. I was delighted to go late into the evening last night with Representative Unger and Representative Davis on land use and UGB issues, and then here we're discussing it again first thing this morning in this committee. I have to say that was a surprise. This particular bill, we are in opposition to the bill as drafted. For many of the reasons you've heard, obviously the economic development tools that we have for our particular association are very important to attracting companies to Oregon. While we certainly support education, we think perhaps it's not the best approach to solving this problem. As you've heard me say repeatedly for a number of my clients, we do look forward to the conversation about overall broader tax reform. I don't think you'll solve that in this short session, though, Mr. Chair. With that, happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Miller, and I'm here to represent the City of Salem. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I did provide written testimony. I just wanted to say, although we understand the importance of this conversation, we are in opposition to the bill as written. We're very interested in participating in the conversation and would like to be helpful in any way that we can. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, other members of the committee. For the record, Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. The issue we believe that has been raised by this bill isn't one about priorities, but instead one of tactics. The question before us is, what, if anything, does this state and our local governments do to incentivize economic development, to grow the tax base that we think is necessary to provide the services, the governmental services that Oregonians value, with education undoubtedly topping the list. I think it's an issue of tactics, because I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any city council or any city councilor who doesn't believe that a well-funded, well-run or education system is vital to its community's present being and future economic well-being. Since we're talking about property tax abatements, most of you know that there are a few organizations in this building that take property taxes more seriously than the League. We've been out front advocating for changes to our property tax system, because unlike school districts, who only receive about 30% of their funding from property taxes are the largest source of funding for most of our cities, oftentimes by an order of magnitude. So the idea that we would be foregoing property taxes without some benefit to the tax base eventually simply isn't accurate. So we value the economic tools that are at our disposal, and we review them pretty carefully. It's important to note that when we're talking about the strategic investment program and the enterprise zone program, you all, the legislature, has established criteria for the eligibility of these projects. On the E-Zone program, the requirement is that 10%, any employer eligible, increase employment by 10%, and after the five-year abatement period on new machinery and equipment, those jobs have to be 150% of the county median wage. So these are good-paying jobs in areas of the state that also need it most. The other criteria is that to locate an E-zone, it has to be in an area where the median household income is 80% or less of the statewide average, or where unemployment is 2% higher than the statewide average. So we're talking about investments in areas of the state that need it most, and in which the payback period is pretty short, the abatement period is pretty short. In terms of the SIP program, the size of the investment, $25 million in a rural area or $100 million in an urban area, means that this is research-intensive, manufacturing-intensive, high capital investment areas that yield high-paying jobs as well. The stated goal of this body and individual legislators, multiple sessions at multiple hearings, is to grow middle-class jobs in this state. We think that these two programs are critical to doing both. That's why we think their preservation and continuation is a good investment for the state and for the taxing districts. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Bailey, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fick, I appreciate your comments about tactics versus outcomes. Is local government opposed to having the education community at the table when deciding the best way forward on these tactics?
Representative Barnhart, Chair Barnhart, Representative Bailey, absolutely not. It's worth noting that both of these programs, the Strategic Investment Program and the Enterprise Zone Program, require public input. They require public hearings. So local school boards, community colleges, other vested groups are welcome to weigh in. I would say that politically, when you do face opposition for any of these economic development programs from the schools, it's significantly more difficult to implement locally. So their consent and agreement is critical not only to the process, but to the public perception of the value that we're getting back.
Yes, please.
Follow-up comment and then perhaps a question.
Yes, sure.
Just a brief comment to say I appreciate the public hearing portion of that public comment period. I would hope and encourage as well that there is direct outreach to the education community to specifically ask for their involvement in that process, although no doubt they will be part of that public comment process. I also wanted to ask you about, again, that trade-off that you mentioned, dollars into economic development incentives versus dollars into the classroom in terms of overall economic outcomes. Do you feel that this is a better use of those dollars than putting dollars directly into the classroom?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bailey, we do. We think that in the end, these programs provide more money to education. And whether you look at the Strategic Investment Program and its payback in terms of income taxes generated, or the short time period for E-zones to be repaid and to be recouped by the local taxing districts, I would say yes.
Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as we're asking questions for Mr. Vick.
Lucky me.
So do you see value in the carve-out of education? It seems to me if it's a bad incentive, why limit the carve-out to just education?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Vance, if I understand your question, why limit it to just education, let special districts, counties, whoever's not making the incentive? Well, you get the program completely if you do that. So, in essence, you would, render its usability down to zero. Now, you can make the argument that if it is not a not worthwhile project, then that's exactly where it should be. I would counter that a lot of the other districts that are weighing in don't have the same level of expertise that a lot of our economic development people do in analyzing what the benefit is going to be to the community.
Thank you.
Others? Your assertion earlier essentially was that you concentrate pretty carefully on the but-for question, that you're not going to give an incentive when you are pretty sure that the business is coming in anyway. And I certainly hope that's the case. One of the things I'm aware of is that there is a disconnect to some extent between the focus of a local economic development piece and the local effect of it and the statewide dispersal of the effect on the education budget as Wimmer described. I wonder if it makes sense, and I don't need an answer today, but if it makes sense for a notice of these kinds of considerations for public hearing actually went to statewide organizations that deal with education budgets, because that's where the effect is, it occurs. When an incentive is given locally that involves an education budget, at least at the K-12 level, the effect of it is to reduce funding statewide. And that's simply a thought for future reference. There is an asymmetry in interests because of the way our very strange funding system works. Representative Berger, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, to your point, but it is also true that, well, it may reduce property taxes to school districts statewide. It could very possibly and hopefully increase income taxes
right.
on a statewide. That's the trade-off we're talking about here, and it is a very...
I suspect Sean was about to say that.
Well, yeah.
And, Mr. Chair, I know that Eco Northwest put together a pretty good paper on some of these incentives as well, and I would hope if the committee doesn't have it, we'd certainly be willing to forward it. I think it's interesting, and it goes back to Representative Unger's comments, too, about competing with Texas, and we are in a globally competitive environment
yes.
to bring in the right type of businesses. And I think I have a unique perspective in that I'm a native Oregonian who went and lobbied for the city of Henderson, the fastest growing city in Nevada, where it was no holds barred. I think probably there's a happy medium in between the two. And so when we kind of say that there's only winners and losers and it's black or white, it's not. And there's a variety of factors that bring companies to Oregon. We recognize that it's a variety of factors. Each little piece might help land that big company. It's not just one single incentive that does that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any other questions for this panel? And then thank you. So our last panel then is Tricia Smith and Cappy Eaton, please. We have 18 bills, and we're hearing almost all of them. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent the 20,000 members of Oregon School Employees Association. I will be very brief this morning. You've had much good testimony on this bill and the ideas behind it. I'm here to offer our strong support for this discussion. The difficulty that we face with these property tax abatement ideas, while they may be very good ideas for the local community considering them, it is very difficult for them to consider, as other people have said, the statewide impact on education as a result of how our two tax systems work together. Often in this committee, when you're hearing testimony urging you to create a new tax break or to expand or extend a tax break, what you hear about are the local benefits of that, the supposed local benefits of that tax break. We hope in this discussion that you ask for some hard data, not estimates, not opinions, but hard data. What do we actually get as a state not just as a community, but as a state, for these policies, and what does it cost us, so that we can be making a better, more broadly informed decision about whether or not they are good for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. League of Women Voters.
Yes. Good morning, Chair Bernhardt, members of the committee. For the record, Kathy Eaton, the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I'm here to ask you to please consider that 4141 is but the beginning of a very important discussion, or a continuing discussion, on how we are going to fund education in this state. And as we move forward with this new system, looking at all of the implications of how a local school districts can address this important new whole seamless system. We have left for almost 25 years the school districts locally to deal with declining revenue. Measure 5 set us on a course that has done nothing but diminish Oregon's ability to educate its students. So we join in the chorus that you've heard this morning to consider that 4141 is a discussion that needs to continue, and looking at all of the various options which have been offered to you by the speakers before me. So we urge the committee to discuss the issues raised and consider a placeholder during the interim, and come in 2015 with some suggestions for how we can deal with this problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for these two? Thank you. We very much appreciate your testimony. I would simply like to note that I think Ms. Smith's suggestion in terms of getting hard data is an extremely good one. I appreciate Sean Gillian's suggestion that he would share again with us the report he referred to. There are probably other reports. I also would note that there are interactions within this system between bills like this one, bills that have to do with gain share, and other aspects, all of which sort of interact in an interesting way. And it's one of the areas that this committee really likes to dig into with great gusto. So we're interested, I think, in pursuing all of those ideas. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on this bill, which is, which bill am I, 4141. And we'll open, let's see, we have six people on 4039, so we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 4039. We'll go with that one next. Is that yours?
Yes.
Yeah, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4039 has a -1 amendment that is available in OLIS. The bill would make explicit that the property tax exemption for property of a nonprofit corporation that was used as low-income housing and had been historically granted exemption by the county as of July 1st, 2012, would continue to receive that exemption. There is currently a court case that is to the Supreme Court level where the decision of the lower court was that the properties that were provided to low-income residents could not be receiving the exemption because they were actually occupied by the low-income tenants and not a nonprofit entity. And so the measure also provides for refunds without interest of property tax from the 2012-13 and 2013-14 tax years, and provides that exemption going into the future for these entities. There is $157.7 million in tax expenditure for all of these nonprofit scientific, literary, and charitable organizations. The information is not available about how many of these are nonprofit corporations that provide low-income housing, so it's some portion of that impact.
Okay. I'm just going to start from the top of the list. Jim Seymour, David
Hilligman.
Hilligman,
thank you. And Jessica Adamson, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Jessica Adamson, and on behalf of Catholic Community Services, we appreciate the hearing today on House Bill 4039. With me today is Jim Seymour, Executive Director of Catholic Community Services, who will go through the history and why we've requested this bill, as well as what it will and will not accomplish. But before Jim begins, I wanted to just take a moment and thank the Association of Oregon Counties for working with us, as well as the Oregon Housing Association on the Dash 1 Amendment. This amendment is very important and part of what we would support as a final bill. In addition, we appreciate the other organizations, the Oregon Opportunity Network, Shelter Care, and Multifamily Northwest that have assisted us in providing comment and input on this bill. So Mr. Hilligman is the attorney for Catholic Community Services. I am not an attorney, and I don't play one on TV. So to the extent that there are questions about the court case, Mr. Hilligman is here today to help answer those questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Good. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Seymour. I'm the executive director at Catholic Community Services here in Salem, Oregon. We are a 501c3 organization which provides a wide variety of services in support of vulnerable children, adults, and families in the Mid-Willamette Valley, including the operation of 100 units of affordable housing that are scattered throughout the greater Salem area. Catholic Community Services has provided low-income housing options for Marion County for more than a decade. The individuals and families we serve include youth aging out of foster care.
You're reading again, aren't you, from the material that we already have?
Yes,
I think it would be
very useful
if you could summarize the points you're making. I'll ask the committee to read it, because we were really pushed for time today, and I appreciate that very much.
Mr. Chair, I think one of the points, if I could direct your attention to the urban development newsletter. This is
yes.
a young mom that we provided foster care to for about 10 years. She lived in the housing that we provide while she was in foster care. After she left foster care and had her son, Maddox, she came back to live in one of our affordable housing units. And while she was there, we were able to support her to find work. She's paying taxes and going to college part-time. I think this is an example of what our work is able to do when people are able to be in safe and stable and affordable housing. And what's happened is that the result of the tax case down in Corvallis is that a new housing development that we brought online that served exactly these same families that in the past has been tax exempt was denied the tax exemption. We had built the tax exemption into our business model in order to be able to provide this housing, and now it was a business model that, you know, we broke even. We don't need to make a profit, but we can't run in the red. And so we're very clear that this bill doesn't solve that problem with this one unit, but it does create a placeholder for us and buy some time where we can work out a more long-term solution to this problem. So I think that's about as cutting to the chase as I can get.
Mr. Chair, if I may, there are some agreements that we have made with the Association of Oregon Counties that we would like to highlight for this committee, as well as some additional background. So I appreciate you have short time, but if you would indulge me for just a moment, we want to make sure that this issue is clear because it is complex. The court case that we refer to is Corvallis Neighborhood Housing Services versus Linn County. The issue in play is a provision of ORS 307-130 that speaks to an exemption for a wide variety of institutions, but that which nonprofit low-income housing properties such as Catholic Community Services, as well as many others, have relied on, that the tax court said that because the statute says that the nonprofit entity needs to have exclusive use or occupancy of that property, that the landlord-tenant laws run into and create a conflict there. Landlord-tenant law requires that the lease agreement is in place that grants use and occupancy rights to the tenant. In this case, those are the subject of the charity as opposed to the actual nonprofit entity. Because the tenant has it some rights, and they're exclusive, or not exclusive, but some occupancy and use rights, the nonprofit no longer has exclusive use or occupancy, thus creating this question about the exemption. The case is on appeal to the Supreme Court. This bill is not designed at all to resolve that court case. In fact, it will not affect the facts of that case. As Jim indicated, it will not solve the problem on that one property for Catholic Community Services. Rather, what this bill buys is time. It gives us time and certainty in order with the Dash 1 amendment in order to enable those who had property tax exemptions in place as of the 2012 tax year for nonprofit providers of low-income housing to rely on those exemptions until the start of the 2018 property tax year. That gives us an opportunity to see what the Supreme Court decides and then work together as the nonprofit housing community as well as the assessors and the counties to find a solution that enables these properties to continue to be financially viable while clearing up the law. What we know for sure is the court has said it is unclear and we need clarity. We agree that the Supreme Court needs to rule. It is our hope that they will overturn the tax court's opinion, but we want to make sure that you know that there is no impact on this bill, either on county revenues. We've designed that not if you don't have an exemption today or didn't have one as of the 2012 tax year, you aren't getting a new one, but those who had them get to keep them. In addition, we wanted to make sure that you knew that the Dash 1 amendment was important.
That's the sunset.
That's the sunset provision, yes. And I believe that we got all of the provisions on there. I'm looking at Gil because we wanted to make sure that we put some things on the record so that there was no confusion about what we were and were not trying to accomplish. So, again, this is a very complex and lengthy issue, but wanted to make sure that the committee understood what our intent was and that we have had a great relationship working with other advocates to make sure that we meet the needs of everybody in this discussion.
Thank you. Mr. Helgeman?
Thank you, Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee. For a non-lawyer, she does a pretty good job. I might need her to help him write the brief here.
Would you identify yourself for the record,
please? Yes, David Helgeman. I'm an attorney for Catholic Community Services. I practice law here in Salem. I think Jessica has very well outlined what the issues are. I think this provides a safe harbor so we can see what the Supreme Court says about the tax court decision without endangering the exemptions that are granted to existing nonprofit properties that have that exemption. There is a couple comments in the opinion by Judge Breithaupt, who I want to say I have a great deal of regard for. He is the tax court judge that made the decision in this case, and he obviously struggled, and he expressed at the end of the opinion a great sympathy that the effect that this opinion might have on nonprofits. But it's clear as he goes through the statutory discussion in his nine-page opinion that he was unclear as to what the legislative intent was with regard to the interplay between 307.130 and another statute, another exemption statute, which is ORS 307.341. And so if the Supreme Court doesn't reverse the opinion, it does give the legislature the opportunity to clarify its opinion with regard to both of those statutes. And so we're just trying to buy some time to allow them to do that.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Douglas Schmidt, Elizabeth Remley, and John Miller, please. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard this morning on this bill? I know we only have a couple of minutes. Paul, can I hold over until tomorrow the last bill, which is House Bill 4005? Is this a sufficient announcement for that? Thank you.
I'll go.
Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Elizabeth Remley here representing Shelter Care, which is a large affordable housing and homelessness prevention services provider in Lane County. Eugene, we're here to support House Bill 4039. We appreciate what Catholic Community Services has done on this. We think that this is an interesting situation, and we hope to be able to resolve this and set a standard for the rest of the state. In Lane County, Shelter Care has several properties that would fall under the same kind of category. In Eugene, there's a local option that would help them, but they do have Springfield and Glenwood properties, which could potentially have the same situation, and we want to make sure that there's some precedent set on this, and we support what Catholic Community Services does here in Marion County, because it is an important thing to have all over the state. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the president of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. I appreciate the amendments that have been brought. Those were some of the concerns we had. I have submitted testimony. That has changed since the amendments have been submitted. But the main concern that the association has is that this could create conflicting statutes, where the statute that deals with nonprofit low-income housing is ORS 307-541. 307-130 is more of a fraternal benevolent organization, which the Catholic Charities could qualify under, but it doesn't deal with housing. And so that is the only concern that the association has. We don't have an issue with the low-income housing. We would just ask that over the time period of this, before this sunsets, that maybe we can work with the, again, like the other, on how we can move these types of properties out of 130 and into 541 so there's no confusion. Because 130 doesn't deal with housing and the complexities of occupancy. And so it would probably be better to get them qualified under another statute.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm John Miller. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Opportunity Network. Oregon Opportunity Network represents 50 nonprofit housing developers and housing owners and operators here in Oregon. I'm here today to give my strong support for this bill, and I'll keep my comments really brief. I think the panel and the panel before have done a great job of outlining the issues. I did hear one statement that said that, you know, the nonprofits are really harmed by this, and I would actually take issue with that a little bit. The nonprofits, it does hurt our abilities to operate, but I think the real losers are the folks that live in the housing that the nonprofits provide. And this, the effect that taking these exemptions away, nonprofits have very, very slim margins, and it's nearly impossible to really keep them operating at an even keel. And for many years, our members have relied on this 307-130 for this exemption. And taking that away, there's only a couple of ways to adjust that. One, rents have to go up, which really affects families, seniors, people with disabilities, and their ability to make ends meet. Or the nonprofits have to absorb the cost, which just puts the nonprofits in danger, and everybody loses if we have nonprofits fail because of this. So that's all I'll add to this. I just want to say that we strongly support this bill, and we look forward to working over the next 3 years to actually come up with a more lasting solution, because we do recognize that this is an issue that needs to be dealt with. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Mr. Schmidt, recognizing that this has been proposed as a short-term bridge, does that, with the amendment, the sunset amendment, does that change your concern at all about the issue you raised having to do with the apparent conflict between ORS 307.541 and 307.130?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee.
I mean, assuming, let me just sort of add the premise that that this time would be used, among other things, to deal with consolidating the statutes having to do with low-cost nonprofit housing.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I believe that the amendments resolve my concern and the association's concern, because this is a very limited bill and it has been kept limited by the amendments that it doesn't affect new properties that may want to try and qualify under the 130 statute. So we would not have an opposition to this bill moving forward with the amendments, as just the fact that we would like to be involved in the discussion on how to make the system better and easier for the taxpayers to understand and implement.
Great. The amendment I'm aware of is the one that establishes an end date. Are you thinking about something else?
No. I guess, Chair Barnhart, when I was listening to the people talk up here, they were talking about how they did not see this bill as affecting the outcome of the court case.
Yes.
This is a separate issue, and that the amendment does give us time to work through, hopefully, a resolution on where's the best place to put these types of properties in statute. And so,
well, I just added this item to our list for 15, for the committee's list for 15, based on the testimony we've heard just now. I don't know whether that has any assurance to your position or not, but I'm
no. I think it's Chair Barnhart. I think it's a move that the Assessors Association would support, because there is confusion not only by the taxpayers but by the assessors of how would these qualify under the statute of 130. Mm-hmm. If the legislature decides to expand 307-130 to take these in, we would like to be able to work with that or move them over into another statute, just so it's clearly identified and it doesn't have to go through litigation again to resolve an unclear issue.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Look, just for sort of a preliminary thought, your concerns about the fact that we seem to have different statutes and we're sneaking this in under one that was really intended for something else, I think that's a worthy area for study and review. And so I really appreciate your raising the issue. We want to make certain that we do have low-cost housing where we can manage it and where it makes sense. But having it all in one statute also makes a lot of sense. Even if there may be different criteria available in that statute for different low-income housing. Obviously not a topic to deal with in the short session.
Yeah. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I think the Assessors Association would agree with that. The statutes are complex, obviously, and I think if we can clarify them, get the associations that deal with the low-income housing identified correctly, it not only clarifies for us and creates a brighter line as to what qualifies, what doesn't. And so I would support, looking at legislation, and hopefully we can be involved so that we can help on the front end to make sure that the legislation is workable for the assessors who have to implement it.
Thank you. Consider that the invitation's been issued.
Okay, thank you.
My
presidency ends in August, and the new president, I'm sure, will support mine.
We appreciate very much the expert involvement of the association in these complex matters, and we want to get them right and make it work and not have situations arise where somebody builds a business plan with one set of rules in mind and then suddenly has the stuffing knocked out of them because of a court case, because our statute's not clear, and we need to make them clear.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, this is the last thing that I would want to do, is come before the committee and offer opposition to something that the public needs. I would rather have it be fleshed out up front and any issues resolved up front than to have to come before you and say this is going to be difficult to implement.
Thank you very much. Anything else for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing. colleagues, I used up 4 of the 7 minutes you got back yesterday, and with that, the committee is adjourned. See you all tomorrow.